This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Governing to Win, exploring ideas to enhancing national competitiveness. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. The IBM Center has recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Proe, which brings together insightful essays by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. How can our nation better compete to win in today's global economy? What is national competitiveness? And how can the federal government's purchasing and supply chains be transformed? Today, we will explore these questions and so much more with our guest, Raj Sharma, founder of the Federal Acquisition, Innovation, and Reform Institute, and contributor to Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches. Raj, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thank you for having me here.
So I've been asking all the folks who've contributed to the book Governing to Win, what actually is meant by the concept of national competitiveness? Could you give me your perspective?
Sure. So I could define competitiveness more generally, but I'll define it in the context of purchasing and supply chain management and the topic that I wrote about in the book. So from that perspective, regardless of whether you believe in small government, large government, whatever the size of government, I think everyone would agree that we want an effective government and a government that really maximizes every dollar's value. And so from that standpoint, really government has so many very complex policy areas. So in terms of competitiveness, whether it's infrastructure or clean energy or education, whatever innovation, to do all of those things, the government definitely needs help from its supply chain partners, right? So the way we look at it, if we want a competitive federal government that can help U.S. be the strongest economy, strongest nation in the world, then we really need to leverage the best capabilities in the most efficient way possible from its supply chain. So the way I think about it is if we can align the supply chain partners with the federal government's priority areas that really are leading to competitiveness, then we can really help accomplish the goal, overall goal of competitiveness.
So Raj, the federal government purchases more than, I understand, $500 billion of goods and services each year. In setting the stage, would you outline why the federal government purchasing process is cumbersome and inefficient? And what are some of the key reasons for this situation?
Well, it's just an extremely, extremely complex environment. I've thought about three or four key reasons. One is you look at every department out there. Are extremely decentralized. First of all, these are very large, complex bureaucracies to begin with, and then they're very decentralized. So the people at the top, yes, they control policy, et cetera, but in many ways, the funding, whether it's through appropriations, et cetera, flows down directly to sub-organizations. And so it's very decentralized. Having any kind of coordination and control is very difficult. The process, then, of that's dictated through the FAR as well as just through other policies that are layered on top is extremely complex. So as we know, the intent of the FAR is really to ensure best value. But in many ways, it works against that because of the complexity. We've layered so much complexity that it's created extra costs both for operating the procurement process as well as for the supply chain partners. So they're incurring a lot of costs. Third is really, this is one of the defining areas that I think adds the most complexity is stakeholders in terms of whether we're looking at responding to congressional requests or we're talking about special interest groups. Just knowing what those set of stakeholders are, what policies or what areas they might be interested in. For instance, we need to comply with small business goals, right? And there's a whole small business lobby and interest groups around that. Again, nobody would disagree with those goals, but it just adds complexity in terms of when where private sector entities may be able to just think about, okay, how do we streamline our supply chain and go to one supplier in that example? Mm-hmm. Federal government can't do that. And the fourth is funding. Really, the way the funding flows through appropriations, a lot of times a single-year process, as well as we know that anybody who's lived in this town knows about continuing resolutions. Mm-hmm. So all of those things really add a level of inefficiency mm-hmm. because suppliers, when one, programs aren't able to plan, two, suppliers don't have visibility into how much business are they really going to get? So that adds more cost for them as a result.
And as you point out in your very balanced piece, it's not all bad news. There were some and have been some opportunities to reform the current system, but some of them have been incremental and others haven't really worked out. Could you give us some of the, maybe highlight some of the primary reasons why previous reforms didn't work?
Well, in my estimation, at least as I've gone back and studied and looked at different reform efforts, one of the things that's lacking, it's a lot of times it's a reaction when we start a reform, whether it's impending cuts, et cetera, which is fine. And you want to use the current environment as a basis to build a burning platform. But a lot of times these efforts get grounded in just really addressing the current issue as opposed to having a clear vision for what the end goal is. Mm-hmm. Right? And without that end goal, we're not really solving the problem. We might be addressing the specific issue at hand on for that day mm-hmm. or for that year, for that administration, but we're not addressing what are the systemic issues that are wrong with the system. So one, we haven't seen a clear vision of what is the system supposed to accomplish. And then two, because we don't do that, a lot of times, so we're talking about cost cuts and some agencies, say, take on restructuring contracts, for instance, right? What they're not doing is changing underlying organizations, processes, policies, et cetera. So maybe you streamline and restructure a contract and gets government the best value for that period, right? But because we haven't changed the underlying behaviors, et cetera, and the policies, processes, all of those things creep back in. Mm-hmm. And so we really end up in the same place as we have before. So that's why you have this reform discussion going on for decades. Mm-hmm.
How has the current fiscal environment provided an unprecedented opportunity to not only transform the way government purchases, but the way it manages its supply chain?
Well, there are a couple of things going on right now. One, everybody knows the whole budget picture, no matter where you live. You don't have to be in D.C. to understand that. So this is really the best time. There's never been a time that I can remember where agencies really have to start to think about how do we live within its means and actually do more with less. And then the acquisition process itself, because of some of the pitfalls and some of the issues that have happened over time, has gotten so much scrutiny. It's also because of the amount of money being spent, over $500 billion, that there's a lot of attention being paid to supply chain and procurement and all those issues, how government buys and manages. So that's really brought the attention at the leadership level. So it started to create more of a platform for what do we do about it. So we finally have the leadership's attention, as well as if we can tie it to the budget picture and say not only can the government reduce costs, but honestly, in the examples and the areas that I'll highlight, we can actually think by reducing costs because you're simplifying the process in many ways and taking the complexity away, you can actually be more effective while reducing cost.
So to what extent does your pragmatic approach that you lay out in your piece go beyond simply the discussion of tactics and more towards expressed reform?
Well, when I started thinking about this and when John Kaminsky approached me about writing this chapter, I had been thinking about this for a while, and so this was an avenue to write through. But the fundamental question to me, just like any program, so if we take any program or any strategic initiative or anything you're doing, you have to think about what's the end goal. What will I consider success, right? What measures of success are there? In terms of going beyond tactics to becoming really more strategic in our thinking, I've really thought about what's the goal of procurement? What do we want? Do we want it to most effectively align the best suppliers so we can meet our mission, right, in the most efficient way? And what are the performance measures help ensure compliance against all the rules, et cetera? Right, make sure that we're meeting small business goals. What are really the end goals? What are those key performance measures, outcome measures that we would look at? And then really design the system to enable those.
Your piece for Governing to Win is Rethink Government Purchasing and Supply Chains. And you do a wonderful job outlining 9 recommendations, and they're very concrete recommendations. But before we delve into each recommendation, I want to understand how you came up with each one and sure. What research went into crafting them. And can you tell us a little bit about how you did it?
So it's really I'll just say it's a body of work over time. And it was in that I was undertaking a project just to write this chapter. It was really a body of work. One, I personally have over 18 years of experience working both with large private sector organizations as well as with government on really addressing supply chain procurement issues. So I understand a lot of the best practices, et cetera. Also consulted with over the past several years and been working with experts both in industry, people like Dave Nelson, who's very well known and as a supply chain guru, former head of Honda of America purchasing, John Deere purchasing. He helped transform those organizations. And also working with academics in leading institutions like Michigan State University, for instance, was ranked number one as a supply chain school, and working with the faculty there and looking at their body of work and really closely with them. So that, and then finally also working with and talking to federal executives and understanding their challenges. So not only are we talking about private sector practices, but how do they really fit in the federal environment?
What about pursuing a pragmatic approach to transforming the role of government purchasing? We will explore this question and so much more when the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Governing to Win, returns. This is The Center This Week, highlighting the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness, brought to you by the IBM Center for the Business of Government. I'm Michael Keegan, Managing Editor of the Business of Government magazine. The Center This Week is our opportunity to inform and, most importantly, to invite you, our listeners, to use the IBM Center for the Business of Government as your resource, a how-to resource for improving government effectiveness at the state, local, and federal level. The IBM Center has recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Pro, which brings together insightful essays by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. Joining me today is the editor of Governing to Win, Chuck Pro. Chuck, welcome.
Great to be here this morning.
So, Chuck, what is national competitiveness?
As we all know, the government is facing a significant financial realities at this point in time. And at IBM, we spend a lot of energy working with clients to improve their performance every day. And that performance ranges in various ways of both operational and technology improvement. As we work with our clients, it has become very, very clear that the overarching conversation with regard to the fiscal realities is not just about doing things better in government. It's about doing things better in government because it ultimately improves our national competitiveness. You know, as an example, the government is 25% of the U.S. economy, 25% of our GDP. And in that 25% of the GDP, we have the government being the largest consumer of undergraduate talent. We are the largest consumer of healthcare. We are the largest consumer of energy of any other enterprise in the United States. And that 25% of our GDP needs to be fundamentally operating at a high level. And when it operates at a high level, it ultimately improves our national competitiveness.
Oh, great. With that context, I'd like to understand what prompted you to put the book together. But more importantly, the book is made up of three particular sections. Could you highlight each one of those sections for us?
Sure. What prompted us to put the book together was just our attempt at framing the conversation. Okay, this isn't about, you know, looking at, you know, small pieces of government and concluding that it either works well or doesn't work well. You know, what the book is intended to do is to provide that context that says, as an enterprise, the way we run and manage the federal government has a substantial or a substantive role in improving our national competitiveness. Imagine if, as the largest consumer of undergraduate talent, we were also the most effective institution at developing that talent. You know, imagine if, as the largest consumer of healthcare, we were actually setting the standards for the way we drive down cost of healthcare over time and improve the way healthcare is administered in the United States. Imagine if, as the largest consumer of energy, we were the gold standard in energy efficiency and the consumption of energy. Those are just three examples. So the book, in providing context, the first chapter really, hopefully in layman's terms, describes the fiscal situation we're in. It also tries to make the point that this is not about being Republican or Democrat, right or left. It's about being Americans. And as Americans, our government has some significant structural financial issues. And there are a lot of great people out there with great and great minds and a lot of great studies. There are solutions to these problems. And the first chapter just tries to put that in context from a layman's perspective. The second section is focused on the three issues I've already mentioned. It's healthcare, energy, and education. The third chapter is focused on the aspects of managing the federal government that are exclusive of the three topics we talked about in the second session. It is really managing government. It is the application of technology. It is the way we run our supply chains. It is the way we provide shared services to our citizens. And hopefully what the third chapter also does, it provides a real-world example of where government is operating very, very effectively today. This book is not about saying government is not running well, we need to do better. This book is all about saying, okay, there are some great examples inside the federal government today of where we are operating at a high level of effectiveness and saving a lot of money for the taxpayers every day, but it's not systemic. And hopefully what this book tries to do is to put that in context. So we're framing the economic situation in the federal government. We're talking about three very large issues of energy, health, and education. And then finally, we're talking about in the third chapter how we actually manage government.
So, Chuck, would you elaborate on your proposed new conceptual framework, Enterprise USA, and more importantly, how can adopting such an approach be a catalyst for improving the competitiveness of the broader economy?
Sure. It's a great question, and this is really a work in process. So we call it a new concept, but the government in general, through the various management offices in government, are every day focused on improving government. This book hopefully just provides some clarity in terms of how we look at improving performance and how we measure improving performance. It struck me. I spent the first 20 or so years of my career in consulting to consumer enterprises and the last 12 to 14 years serving the federal government and state governments. And it struck me very early in that transition into government consulting that the clarity provided by the financial realities of commercial enterprises is amazingly clear. You know, companies are measured on EBITDA, how much cash do they generate, and ROI, how effectively do they turn that cash. It's very clear. When you move to the government, I mean, the government, as much as we like to oversimplify it, is not like running a company. It's very different. And the men and women who serve the government in these capacities do a very, very good job in a very, very difficult environment. But having said that, it is inescapable that there isn't the same level of clarity. And what this book attempts to do is to provide clarity around what value is in the federal government. The federal government comprises dozens and dozens of missions, and those missions are typically statutorily defined. They're very clear. And those missions can be measured. And what the book tries to outline is a very, very simple proposition that says that all of these missions are required to have a certain level of service, perform a certain level of quality for a certain amount of cost in a certain amount of time. And anything we can do to take time or cost out of one of these missions without negatively affecting service or quality, by definition, is a good thing. The big dimension of the equation is time. Because, I mean, ultimately at its core, the federal government is composed of dozens and dozens of white-collar processes. These white-collar processes typically have bottlenecks. And anything we can do as government and as industry serving government to take time out of the service and out of the mission without negatively impacting mission effectiveness will ultimately drive increased value.
This has been the Center This Week with my guest today, Chuck Proe, editor of Governing to Win, enhancing national competitiveness through new policy and operating approaches. The book is available at bookstores, online booksellers, and from the publisher at romanlittlefield.com. For information on other Center resources, go to businessofgovernment.org. There you will see that the business of government is not business as usual. For the IBM Center for the Business of Government, I'm Michael Keegan, and this has been the Center This Week. The IBM Center for the Business of Government has recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Proe, which brings together insightful essays by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. How can our nation better compete in today's global economy? And how can moving to an Enterprise USA approach in government enhance our national competitiveness? This book explores these questions and so much more. Governing to Win is available at bookstores, online booksellers, and from the publisher, romanlittlefield.com. How can we enhance national competitiveness? What about getting big things done in government? And how can government better manage risks and use resources more wisely? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. Hear from Comptroller General Gene Dodaro, SSA Commissioner Michael Astrew, Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Robert Papp, NGA Director Tish Long, and Aaron Connaughton on the Air Force's strategic vision. All of this and so much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Governing to Win, exploring ideas to enhancing national competitiveness. My guest today is Raj Sharma, author of Rethink Government Purchasing and Supply Chains, and contributor to the recent IBM Center book, Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches. So Raj, in your piece, you suggest re-envisioning the role of government purchasing from managing purchases and price to managing supply chain and total cost. Would you elaborate on that for us?
Sure. Really, the issue is that right now, all of the work that we do in the federal government in terms of purchasing, or most of it, if you looked at what people are spending most of their time on, the entire workforce, it's really on individually managing contracts, transactions. And a lot of times it is the focus, as much as we talk about best value, it is about managing the price of that transaction. What are we negotiating for that? But we know that, first of all, price versus cost, that there's a lot of times in no matter what you're looking at, price is just a small component of the total cost. So we really need to look at the whole picture. And then two, because we talked about the decentralized nature of government, we're doing things transactionally. We need to take a step back and say, what are the types of things we're buying? Who are we buying them from? Mm-hmm. What are our biggest supply chains, mm-hmm. right? And then how do we manage them? So what are the biggest supply chains? So let's say we're acquiring technology expertise around certain types of programs, right? How do we, instead of really reacting to every transaction, every need, say, what's the long-term outlook? What does the need look like? What are the set of capabilities resident in the suppliers? Right. And how do we best work together over the long term and then really figure out how do we then have transactions against that as opposed to so it's really moving to a much more strategic way of looking at what are our long term needs, how does it help us accomplish certain goals, and then who are the partners that we want to work with over time, and then really set up a process and a roadmap to execute against that as opposed to every transaction comes in and then reacting to it.
So, crafting this strategic approach, you're going to need certain key capabilities. And your piece does a wonderful job of outlining at least three key capabilities fundamental to world-class purchasing agencies. Would you tell us what those are?
Yeah, and this is partly, and again, as I mentioned, I've talked to many experts and leading thinkers out there. So Dr. Tim Lasseter, who I work with closely, he's at the University of Virginia. He wrote a book a few years ago called Balanced Sourcing, and in that he highlighted key capabilities fundamental to world-class organizations. Those are really, and I agree with those, strategic sourcing is one of them. Sometimes it's called category management. And strategic sourcing, really beyond leverage buying, which a lot of people think it is, it's more about, again, taking a step back and saying, what are the categories of supplies or services we buy, and then how do we strategically manage them? What kind of contracts do we need in place? What kind of suppliers do we need? What capabilities? The second is supply relationship management. And that's really about many times, whether it's by design or just happenstance, there are many large suppliers that you end up working with. Mm-hmm. How do we really manage those relationships in a strategic way again, as opposed to working with them on one-off contracts? Can we really take a step back and have strategic dialogues with those suppliers and really build a relationship and a framework to say, okay, hey, you're a partner, you're a strategic partner for us. This is what you help us do. Really, how can we both ensure that we deliver against and have the impact that we want? And it's really working and having that open dialogue with suppliers and jointly thinking about where can you drive value. And then the third is cost modeling. The world's best organizations, you look at Honda and Toyota, Japanese really are pioneers at this. They not only understand their costs, but they understand their suppliers' costs and their suppliers' costs. So up and down the supply chain, better than most suppliers do themselves. Again, if we're going to move towards an environment that talks about reducing total cost, you need to first understand what the cost is. And that's a very strategic, technical skill set many times. And so the world's best organizations really invest in that and build that capability. And it really becomes an intelligence. It gives you more transparency into what's going on in your supply chain then.
And you make better decisions, better strategic decisions.
Definitely, because then you're able to see what's driving costs, right? Instead of focusing on, say, oh, should I negotiate this price for a certain piece of equipment, if I know that most of the cost is being driven off of, say, the maintenance part of it, right? If I can figure out and really work with the supplier and negotiate in a certain way to really manage and reduce the maintenance costs, maybe I won't even care about the price because it's such a small component. Mm-hmm. So understanding that cost picture is really critical. Then it helps you focus and lay out your priorities in the right way.
Well, your piece also actually has some very practical suggestions. And one of them is you call for the appointment of a federal supply chain officer that could lead a new office, the Office of Federal Supply Chain Management. Would you describe this new role and the mission of the suggested office?
So really, the issue is similar to we talk about a tactical role for, and I talk about in the chapter about tactical role that the chief procurement officers have. Similarly, the Office of Federal Procurement Policy, that term that for the office itself implies a policy role as opposed to more of a management role, right? And so really, and going along with how should the government manage supply chains and total cost? At the highest level, if we can have government-wide visibility through a federal supply chain office, just similar to what the federal CIO does, really, what are the largest supply chains that the government works with, right? Who are the customers? Which agencies? What are the performance measures that the government should really be looking at, outcomes that we want to drive? And then what's the roadmap for making sure that the government is getting something out of it? It doesn't mean that the Federal Supply Chain Office manages all of that, but at least it has the understanding of what are those most critical areas, and then how should we as a government work on those?
Well, there's implications, and I think you also set up the fact, how should the role of department-level headquarters and the role of the chief procurement officer change in this vision?
Yeah, right now, one of the issues is it's a lot of times the headquarters, as I mentioned early on, that because agencies are so decentralized, the headquarters really are many times policy offices, mm-hmm. right? And that's very much the case with contracting or procurement. And also, one of the things that we found out in looking at different organizations, many times the chief procurement officer. So here you have a senior executive who's supposed to help manage, you know, billions of dollars most of the time, in, regardless of what agency you're looking at, of spending, but they don't have any control over their resources. Many times the contracting, the procurement resources are actually controlled by their sub-organizations. They might have the ability to issue them contracting warrants, but they don't actually have any dotted line relationship even with or those people. So the question, we sit back and say, you know, if I was an executive in a private sector company, would I actually take that role on where, you know, I'm in charge and accountable for driving certain performance measures, but I have no control over any resources? So that's one of the things that really needs to happen is we need to at least think about what's the link between resources. So, again, it's the importance of human capital management and understanding that, you know, we need to manage our talent. How can I manage our talent if I don't even control any of it? The second part is, you know, having more capability around some of the key things we talked about, sourcing, SRM, et cetera. But being able to centrally manage, you need more of that capability. And also the other thing that private sector organizations do best, the ones we work with, are things like, you know, disseminate best practices, standardize processes and technology, right? Making sure there's a technology infrastructure, training and human capital planning, all of those things.
What are some of the key challenges faced if you want to do this?
Yeah, the biggest challenge is going to be the change management and, again, the trust, right? I think it goes back to capability because the role of headquarters has functioned a certain way and they haven't built that capability. So all of a sudden now saying we want all this control over resources, one, you know, so you're asking some people to give up control over resources that they had. And so that's a definitely you're going to see battles over that. The second is the trust issue related to capability. But in the defense of headquarters procurement, they've never had a role to really play. So they haven't had the capability. But so maybe, you know, the way we think about it, it can be done in a progressive. You have to build that just like in any change management exercise. You have to build it over time. So
well, you've mentioned strategic sourcing. And while it's not new in the federal government, it's still sort of in its infancy being used and such. To what extent should federal agencies strengthen strategic sourcing efforts?
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, I would say that, you know, strategic sourcing as a concept has been around for a long time in the government, but it still hasn't been implemented very effectively. And the biggest reason is most of the time strategic sourcing is being done as a program office, right? You just have some people, but you're not actually integrating strategic sourcing into processes across the organizations. You're not establishing what we call decision rights or ability of, for instance, if you want to centralize some spending of common goods like office supplies, furniture, basic IT, et cetera, you need to then give some funding and formal decision control to central and saying, okay, we can only do this and that. Definitely you can do that through policy right now, but what we've seen is compliance is very difficult to manage that. So really what we really need to do is more integrated into processes and the way we do business as opposed to establishing program offices, which really don't change anything. Definitely you can get some savings. But it those creep back again.
Are there any successes in this area?
Definitely there are successes. I think it's some of the work that Department of Commerce is doing right now, for instance, that's been highlighted in the president's campaign to cut waste. They establish a pretty aggressive effort around strategic sourcing. Similarly, Air Force has reorganized, and that's a massive undertaking to really bring together and coordinate some of the spending across. I think the challenge over there might be that they still haven't really taken away some of the decision rights again from all the different commands, et cetera. So you do have at least a central organization, but the challenge there is still the change management challenge of, okay, how do we really get them to work with us, get the customers actually, and across the different entities. So
you have another interesting recommendation, and it's to federal agencies to establish a supplier performance and relationship management program. What exactly would this program look like in practice?
Yeah, so the issue there is, again, as I highlighted earlier, there are, if you looked at the total $500 billion you can take the top 100 suppliers and they make up over, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, a big portion of the spend. Can we at least start there and start to gain visibility into what's the amount of business we do with them? Mm-hmm. And can one organization, even as one department, so start to really gain an understanding of who are our top suppliers, right? And can we, at a headquarters level, again, start to manage, at least gain visibility and transparency into what the relationship looks like, what are the set of contracts, what services are they, or products are they delivering, right? And then really establish a framework for how do you manage performance, mm-hmm. both performance, so define the measures of performance, and then also where are there gaps in performance so we can develop an improvement roadmap. So a lot of times what companies that are best at supplier relationship management, if they do this right and really, one, establish the measures of performance and then also work closely and together with their suppliers, they're able to really jointly reduce costs. The best companies in the world, frankly, don't even impact the profit. They don't go after the profit percentage of companies. What they do is take the waste out of the entire system so everybody benefits. You can still maintain that same profit level. And another key benefit is innovation. Mm-hmm. So if you're working closer with suppliers, you better understand what are the things they're investing in from an R&D standpoint. What capabilities are they developing? So then if we have a program, we can better understand that when we're laying out our strategic goals, we can make sure that we are able to leverage those capabilities. So we're able to innovate. And the world's best, most sophisticated companies not only use the supplier relationship management as a way to manage costs and reduce costs, but it's a way to actually drive the top line and through innovation. So they're able to take technology, they're able to take capabilities that are being developed and use them in their products and their services. And the government, while they're not going to reduce or increase revenues, but they can still deliver better services to citizens as a result.
A little bit off topic, but yep. it prompted a question around yep. the idea of the way the federal government actually procures stuff. It's through regulation or the FAR, yep. as an example. How having this kind of relationship program, would there be an impact in terms of the relationship between a supplier and the government?
Yeah, and this does not in any way imply a do away with the competitive process,
okay,
right?
I mean.
So you still want to have a competitive process. You want to have a very transparent process. But what you can do is make sure once you have selected the supplier, right, then you're doing certain things to make sure that you're exchanging information and driving the most value out of their relationship. So it is really and the statement I always use is that if you look at private sector companies, mm-hmm. they have the most motivation to get the best deal, right? Because
yep.
they're profit driven. But they're the ones who drive these supplier relationship management the most. Why? If they were actually losing money as a result, they wouldn't be doing this, right? And so they see a lot of value. And you look at the best companies like Honda, et cetera, again, there's a very different mentality in how you work with suppliers. Again, I do want to qualify. I'm glad you asked that question. It does not mean you do away with the competitive process. Mm-hmm. But frankly, the first statement I made around supplier performance measures, mm-hmm. that's one of the things that's missing right now. So you can't do relationship management before you do performance management. And that's a really important thing. So you have to be very smart about it. You can't start saying, well, let's work with suppliers and let's start kind of hugging and dancing together and, you know, make all sorts of good stuff. You have to do your homework as a buyer first and make sure you know what performance standards you're setting. You have a way to collect data against that, and you're holding suppliers accountable for that. And that's where these things haven't worked before, because government's gone in blind sometimes into these things and just kind of trying to set up long-term relationships, et cetera. But the prerequisite is you got to have performance standards, performance measures, and visibility. So you got to get much more sophisticated about that.
What are the core benefits of pursuing formal acquisition reviews? We will explore this question and so much more when our special edition of the Business of Government Hour returns.
Mm-hmm.
The IBM Center for the Business of Government has recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Pro, which brings together insightful essays by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. How can our nation better compete in today's global economy? And how can moving to an Enterprise USA approach in government enhance our national competitiveness? This book explores these questions and so much more. Governing to Win is available at bookstores, online booksellers, and from the publisher, RomanLittlefield.com. How can we enhance national competitiveness? What about getting big things done in government? And how can government better manage risks and use resources more wisely? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. Hear from Comptroller General Gene Dodaro, SSA Commissioner Michael Astrew, Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Robert Papp, NGA Director Tish Long, and Aaron Connaughton on the Air Force's strategic vision. All of this and so much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Governing to Win, exploring ideas to enhancing national competitiveness. My guest today is Raj Sharma, author of Rethink Government Purchasing and Supply Chains, and contributor to the recent IBM Center book, Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches. So, Raj, the history of government purchasing is littered with stories of colossal failures of major programs. How could establishing a tech stat style review for all major acquisition programs minimize such failures? And what are the core benefits of pursuing a formal acquisition program review process?
Well, first of all, there are some things already in place in different organizations. So I don't want to claim that this is something brand new. At the same time, though, I think the really, again, this idea is more or less stolen from what the CIO community has done with TechStat, and really paying attention to all the money that's invested across major IT programs and putting how do you improve that those outcomes. So similarly, really the goal here is to make sure that program leadership right at the start, from the start, is being held accountable. Mm-hmm. And in terms of thinking about key issues about a program and how acquisition programs support that program. So what I mean by that is we know most programs will end up spending 50, 60, 70% of their budget on actually acquisition and getting capabilities of partners, right? And so the acquisition, major acquisition programs need to obviously support the program goals. So it forces, by having a review process at the highest levels, it forces people to really think, ask the hard questions, not just about the acquisition, but has the program actually thought about what are the goals? What are the outcomes? Because that's where the failure happens in a lot of acquisition programs, is because the programs haven't clearly articulated what are the end outcomes, what are we trying to achieve? How can you get the supply chain partners aligned to help deliver against that, right? So you could do the best procurement in the world, right? You could set up the best contract, but maybe for the wrong set of things. So having it really does require the leadership to be involved. Because these are multi-billion, hundreds of million-dollar programs, right? And so having not just the contracting executive or officer plus the program manager, but really bringing together all the key parties that are playing a role in that program together. And then we recommend that for the largest programs, the chief operating officer or the deputy secretary really hold these reviews. And at the government level, we should outline the top 10 to 20 programs that are ongoing, and we should look at, just like the federal CIO is looking at this, we should similarly have a process where we have both the procurement part of OMB as well as the program management side really working together and instituting this process.
Well, your piece also tackles the workforce dimension, yeah, and the acquisition workforce dimension. I'd like you to outline some of the recommendations you put forward in the piece for restructuring the federal acquisition purchasing workforce. To what extent do government leaders need to promote collaboration and also risk-taking in order to transform the culture?
I'm glad you asked that, because that's one of the issues is really the culture. It's No, definitely, again, in the interest of ensuring the best and most prudent use of taxpayer dollars, you have to make sure that somebody's being held accountable. Right? At the same time, you don't want to do it to a degree where any kind of risk-taking is seen as something that's going to land you in jail. So we need to really prioritize that, especially really focus on the largest, most significant areas to make sure we're doing the right thing. But really the collaboration piece is also needs to happen between really the acquisition, the programs, the requirements, owners, and contracting. And that doesn't happen right now. And really the way I look at it, the root cause behind that is that only in the government do you see the dichotomy between contracting and acquisition, where you say the contracting people write contracts and the acquisition and the other broader acquisition people are the requirements owners, they write requirements. How come in the private sector there is no such thing as contracting and acquisition? It's procurement. And so the problem starts right there because, again, we've defined a very tactical and narrow role for contracting. Is you start getting this siloed approach where people are writing in requirements and people are cutting contracts as opposed to really being an integrated process. So the value chain, the way we look at it, the acquisition value chain is broken to start with. It's set up for failure. And so the collaboration really is marred by that. So we really need to change and rethink what the role of contracting, again, going back to the top of that. That's why I keep going back all the way, linking all of this back to that. And then saying, how do we collaborate? And that will by itself spur collaboration. The other issues around workforce are, you know, there's this whole dialogue around numbers, numbers, numbers. That's great. But and, you know, the way I look at that argument is just adding more and more numbers on top of a bad system doesn't help the problem at all. All we're doing is actually making the problem more severe. We really need to take a step back and, again, look at how have we aligned the people the right way and the right set of capabilities. Now, are we training them on the right set of things? Are we bringing in the right people? Mm-hmm. And then look at, in a redesigned system, how many people do we really need? Right. And we believe really, if you look at the throughput and doing some analysis on this of how much do we process per person mm-hmm. in the government versus private sector, it's ridiculous the differences. And of course, there are differences in terms of in federal, you have to comply with the federal regulations, all those things. So it's more complex. But should the difference be 2 times? Should the difference be 10 times? And so that's what we're looking at.
And you mentioned the federal regulation. And the intent of the federal acquisition regulations, the FAR, as we referred to it, is to ensure stewardship of taxpayer dollars and a level playing field for suppliers. To what extent have the current federal acquisition policies and regulations worked against the system?
I think Vivek Kundra said it best. He I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but he basically said, you know, you need a PhD to understand the federal procurement process. And that's very true. What the regulations and this whole environment has done is instead of create an environment where we can attract more suppliers and create more real, meaningful competition, what we've done is we've created barriers to entry because we have such a complex system that the world's best suppliers don't even care to work with the federal government. I use the analogy of the HR system, right? Just like the best candidates have many options and they're not going to go to the worst companies, or if you have a process like the federal government has in HR, they're not going to go and wait a year to get a job, right? Similarly, suppliers say the cost of doing business and working with the federal government, it's not worth it. So we really need to simplify and streamline. And there are actually people that I've talked to, very influential people that are on board with this. And we need to relook at the FAR, really streamline them. The second thing we recommend is that one is look at the FAR, but the two is you have so many different organizations, entities, whether it's out of Congress and different bodies out of Congress or other organizations that are laying out procurement policy. And many times they end up being conflicting. So SBA might lay out something related to small business goals, but then OMB comes out with something. Or Congress lays a bill out, right? Yeah. And they're conflicting. So we need to really make sure there's an apparatus that's coordinated mm-hmm. so we're not giving conflicting messages to everybody. The workforce, the suppliers, everybody out there.
So you've mentioned, we've just talked about the people, and you talked about policies. Let's talk about technologies, because you mentioned one of the biggest opportunities lies in the government's ability to leverage proven supply chain technologies. Would you tell us more about these technologies and how they can enhance productivity and decrease overall cost?
Sure. I think one of the biggest impediments that I haven't really talked about is to managing and more strategically managing government spending is gaining visibility into what's going on, right? That's the first step, right? Which you can't measure, you can't improve, right? That's how, as the saying goes. So really understanding and gaining visibility into what are all the transactions, who are we working with? So there's a lot of technology out there that really it's built around taking spending data, as they say, and really using artificial intelligence or other ways to really adding more value to that, maybe the data that may not be as clean as we want, and then really adding and cleansing it and normalizing it in ways that really adds a lot more visibility all of a sudden. You know, where you might see something categorized as IT hardware, all of a sudden you can see it's desktops, laptops, software, other different things. So so that's one of the things. It's really the visibility. And there's a lot of technology out there. And the integrated data model that can be set up around those is really critical, because that's the first step. The second set of technologies are really around call them commercial sourcing and marketplace platforms. And we remember from the e-marketplace days back in, you know, back in the late 90s, all the platforms around creating electronic marketplaces, et cetera. Believe it or not, some of them did survive, actually, and they're still thriving. And especially in the commercial or kind of organizational procurement arena, where really these platforms, what they do is they create an ability to automate the process, but also bring suppliers in. And so you can do many more things, like have visibility into pricing on a regular basis. So if you, say, are working with a set of suppliers and you want anybody who's purchasing, you know, certain items like a pen or a box of staples or furniture or whatever it might be, they can easily see what's going on in terms of pricing. The other is they also allow you to do competitive bidding, et cetera, more on a regular basis, and invite more and more suppliers easily into the process. So it really streamlines the process. It simplifies. But the government, frankly, has not, again, gone there too much. There are different systems that agencies are implementing, but government is way behind the curve on this. And there's an opportunity, because in private sector, these companies have invested hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, because they're working across hundreds of companies, right? So there's no need for government to actually build its own technology. It should leverage what's out there, because it really leverages all the lessons. So that is the advantage that the government has now, is because all the lessons have been learned over the last 15 years on how to best use these technologies and what works, what doesn't, how do you really streamline processes, how do you create efficient marketplaces, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Government can benefit from all that knowledge and deploy this. And now it being on the cloud, it's much easier to deploy. You don't have to integrate it into legacy systems and spend as much time. You can more easily deploy it as well. So
Rush, what going forward, what should a holistic supply chain technology strategy seek?
Well, really, holistically, again, and technology, as they say, is it's an enabler, right? It's the end goal isn't to implement technology. It's really, if we look at, you know, what are the end goals of, you know, what we want out of the system of contracting and procurement, it's really around, can we have a more transparent process? Can we better manage cost, right? Can we better understand capabilities of suppliers out there? So a holistic strategy really should be grounded in enabling those set of things. Can we get visibility into performance? Can we also start to create more of a dynamic competitive marketplace? Can we also start to gain more market intelligence into the supplier capabilities? Mm-hmm. So those are the types of things. And they're not all things that you can address through technology. Frankly, you need the human element and the talent on top of that as well. But there are many things going on out there that are already available that government can leverage.
So I'd like to learn a little bit more about you. And in particular, you are the founder of the Federal Acquisition Innovation and Reform Institute. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
So the FAIR Institute started with several like-minded people about 3 years ago, really with the goal of helping innovate the federal acquisition process. And so the makeup of it is really our overall mission is to ensure